This is session number 275, The Principle of Profit in Prison. It's a little dark up here, but I'll introduce our three presenters for this session. The first will be Brian Hales, and I'll put on my German thumb. He's an anesthesiologist in Layton, Utah, and the author of Modern Polygamy and Mormon Fundamentalism, The Generations After the Manifesto. It was awarded the best book of 2007 from the John Whitmer Historical Association. He's also a webmaster of a couple of websites. In addition to full-time LDS mission in Venezuela, he has served as a music missionary since 1999. Our next presenter will be Lori Linder Stromberg. She has an MA in Humanities from BYU, was a former managing editor of the Journal of Modern History, a former associate editor for Sunstone, former editor of Mormon Women's Forum Quarterly, and recently founded Girls Gone Wiki? Yes. Girls Gone Wild is good.
It's Girls Gone Wiki.
And then the response will be given by Todd Compton. These two people are sitting in the audience because they want to see the PowerPoint presentation that Brian will present. Todd, I'm sure most of you know him, is a celebrated and widely published Mormon historian whose works include In Sacred Loneliness, Fire and Sword, and is working on a biography of Jacob Hamlin. I cut those short. So we'll first hear from Brian. This is a 90-minute session. We'd like to leave time for Q&A, but this is a powerhouse trio we've got here, and I don't want to cut them short. So we'll see how it goes with the time. Todd, about how long do you think it'll take?
Oh, about a page and a third for each of them.
About what?
A page and a third.
Oh, okay. Then Lori wanted a little bit more time, so it looks like we're fine. Okay, Brian?
I appreciate you all being here. I think I'm the only person, oh, there's another one, in a white shirt and a tie. And I have been mocked over and over today and accused of trying to impersonate either a general authority or a mortician. And I'm far more qualified to do the latter than the former. And I apologize, but not really, for this shameless plug for my books that are going to be released later this year. Lloyd Erickson put these covers together, and I told him I'd flash them up here. So anyway, we're excited. It's been a five-year project for me, and Lelina and Lloyd Erickson and the editors, I'm Greg Colford's publishing them later this year. The topic is polyandry, and we're going to do a little defining here. Polyandry itself means many men. Doesn't mean many husbands. But sexual polyandry occurs when a woman experiences sexual relations with more than one man in a specific time period. When we talk about polygamy, usually it's within the context of many marriages. A woman married to more than one man, having sexual relations with both. Now, my research supports that 14 of Joseph Smith's plural wives had legal husbands. Now, if they experienced sexual relations with Joseph during the same period they had conjugal relations with their civil husbands, then the women would have been practicing sexual polyandry with both. Did he practice sexual polyandry? Well, I feel kind of alone in my position. And you can't prove a negative, as I'll repeat over and over. But if we, as you'll see in a minute, I think we can at least qualify what the evidences are supporting it and contradicting it. If we look at the evidence, I think that Joseph Smith's teachings contradict the possibility. Four observations. First, and Joseph Smith taught that celestial and plural marriage were part of the new and everlasting covenant. He also taught that all old covenants have I caused to be done away in this thing, and this is the new and everlasting covenant. The covenant then discussed was baptism, and we have no record of Joseph Smith applying this principle to the new and everlasting covenant of marriage, but we also have no record of him contradicting it or saying that it did not apply. The revelation simply states that all old covenants are done away in the new and everlasting covenant. Accordingly, a sealing in the new and everlasting covenant would supersede a legal matrimonial covenant, causing it to be done away. And the woman after, a woman who contracts a legal marriage and an eternal seeking for time and eternity would not thereafter have two lawful husbands, lawful in God's eyes, with whom she could experience sexual relations. Now, second observation is that section 132, the revelation on celestial and plural marriage, describes three possible sexually polyamorous situations and labels all three of them as adultery. Verses 61 through 63 state that as pertaining to the law of the priesthood, if any man espouse a virgin, and if one, after she is espoused, shall be with another man, she has committed adultery and shall be destroyed, for she is given unto him to multiply and replenish the earth. In other words, if she has an eternal husband, and then she has a legal husband afterwards, if she should be with another man, including a legal husband, she's committed adultery, shall be destroyed. And remember this slide because we're going to refer to it later. And it doesn't seem to matter if the legal marriage is first. It doesn't seem to change anything. The eternal marriage would cause the old covenants to be done away. In light of Joseph Smith's revelation, the question for the polyamory proponents, and I've put Todd in that category, and I don't know what he'll say, and I'm grateful he's here. I'm very excited. Because he's one of the few that can really talk about this. But were Joseph Smith's reported sexual polyamorous relationships in accordance with his teachings or in contradiction to his teachings? Third, Joseph Smith taught that everyone must be sealed to be exalted. In his theology, no single man or single woman is exalted. Historical evidence shows that legally married women could be sealed for eternity only to someone other than their civil husbands. The sealed marriage covenant would not apply until the next life. And here's the document. I don't want to spend a lot of time with this. I've written on this, but it's about Ruth Bo Sayers. Her husband encouraged her to be sealed with the prophet for eternity, and then he would claim her in this life. In summary, nothing in Joseph Smith's teachings justifies sexual polyamory, and section 132 describes sexual polyamorous relationships as adultery. So learning that a woman has had two marriage ceremonies does not justify the assumption, in my view, that she was sexually involved with both husbands. Specific evidence of polyamorous sexuality is required. And I don't think there is a lot of this. There's two categories of supportive evidence that can be identified and have been promoted by those who feel that Joseph was doing this. Some authors assert that sexual polyandry is required to fulfill the reproductive purpose of plural marriage. And that was one of the reasons that Joseph Smith gave for plural marriage. But the one that we hear the most of is that it was to restore Old Testament polygamy, and then, of course, multiply and replenish. But the most important one by far, in my view, is that it was to provide spouses for all worthy women. Apparently, he anticipated that at the end of the world, there would be more worthy women than men. It's the only option he provided for. Historically, 19th century Americans considered non-traditional sexual relations, which would have included polyandry, as diminishing fecundity. In other words, they wouldn't have seen sexual polyandry as increasing fertility or as multiplying and replenishing the earth. In his 1841 book, Elements of Obstetric Medicine, Dr. David B. Davis wrote, "It is a general opinion, and one that would seem well-founded, that excess in the use of the means of impregnation," how's that for politically correct, "is upon the whole unfavorable to the interests of fecundity, hence the almost uniform sterility of the more public prostitutes." And actually, their sterility was probably from sexually transmitted diseases. But in other words, in Nauvoo, they just would not have viewed having more husbands as a way of enhancing multiplying. And then physiologically, and we can talk about this in the Q&A, adding a second sperm donor does not enhance women's fertility. Second, the historical evidence of sexual polyandry is not strong. You can go to my website, josephsmithpolygamy.com. These are all of the evidences that I was able to put together about a year ago. There's a few others that have popped up. Nothing that I would say is solid. We're going to talk about a few of these here in a minute. It's impossible to prove something didn't happen. And keep that in mind, but so far I haven't found any solid evidence to support it. Now Todd, again, glad to have him here, but he wrote that it could be argued that in 10 cases there is no evidence of sexuality, and only one case do we have evidence, and those of you who have read in Sacred Bonitas know that it's the case of Sylvia Sessions Lyman. Todd put the evidence together, and since I only have 30 minutes, I was going to ask you to come up and explain what happened the day that he was able to see these documents. He got to handle the real ones. Now if you go in there, you have to deal with the digital versions. But he wasn't able to get to the fourth book and see this one. He used this date in his book But there's another document just as valid with an 1843 date. And anyway, there are other evidences that weren't available to Todd when he wrote his book that indicate this timeline, that Windsor and Sylvia married in 38. She conceived three children. He was excommunicated, and this is why they separated. It wasn't for plural marriage, so far as the evidence indicates. But then Joseph was sealed to Sylvia and conceived one child, and I've only identified two children to plural wives. This is one. Joseph was killed, and then Windsor was rebaptized, and they come back together. The legal marriage was never, there was no legal divorce. It was intact, superseded by the sealing here. Is this weird? Yeah, this is weird. But is it sexual polyandry? Is it immoral? I argue it is not. Now, in the case of Mary Elizabeth Rollins Leitner, I've shortened this just a little bit. Michael Quinn responded to this very same presentation in Calgary just a few weeks ago, and he quoted this from Mary Elizabeth. She said in 1905, "I know that Joseph Smith, had three children, they told me. I think that two of them are living today, but they are not known as his children as they go by other names." And then Michael said these were children of polyandrous wives, and there's just nothing in the document to justify that interpretation. These were just children of Joseph Smith's plural wives, not necessarily the polyandrous wives. The case of Flora Woodworth is interesting. She has a confrontation with Emma on August 22nd, 1843. We're quoting from William Clayton's journal. She demands a watch. Emma stamps it underfoot. The next day, she marries non-Mormon Carlos Guff. Is this a reactive thing? I think absolutely it is. And then 3 days later, after the honeymoon or whatever they did, she and her mother converse with Joseph at Clayton's home. What do they converse about? We don't know. He doesn't say it. But then, on the 28th and the 29th, are two additional visits with Flora Woodworth at Clayton's home. This has been interpreted by some as sexual romps, and it were so good that it made her regret her marriage to Gov. I argue that, no, remember the scripture we read earlier, that if a virgin is married in the new and everlasting covenant, if she should be with another man, she's committed adultery and shall be destroyed. I believe that that's what they were talking about, that there's nothing about sexual. I don't even think the marriage with Flora was consummated, but that's speculation. Skip that. Now, the case of Mary Heron may be new to most of you. And Michael Quinn, in private correspondence, accused me of hiding this or not being entirely honest in some articles that I've written on polyandry. And frankly, he's probably right. You'll see why. I didn't include it. But you'll also see why he felt justified in making the accusation. Joseph Ellis Johnson was involved in an adulterous relationship. And follow on, it's a little complicated. His membership status was discussed in a council meeting September 2, 1850 in Salt Lake City. Brigham Young was presiding. In his own defense, Joseph B. Johnson reported that he was familiar with the first freeing, which is slang for sexual relations, that was done in his house in Ramis, Illinois, with his mother-in-law by Joseph. Joseph E. Johnson's mother-in-law was Mary Heron Snyder. Despite intensive research, and I sent Don Bradley, I hired him for a couple of years, and he spent weeks looking for stuff. We can't find anything. So this is an area where you researchers, you young people, and there's such a great crop coming up, you know, figure something out with this. But I can't find anything linking Joseph with Mary Heron Snyder. But Joseph Ellis Johnson was a devout member, and it was recorded at the time, and it's good evidence. Several interpretations are possibly based upon the assumptions the interpreters are willing to accept. First is a willingness to accept that Johnson was accurate and accurately reported, and I think he was. So, if we assume that there was no plural sealing, then the relationship was adultery. If we assume that a plural sealing occurred and conjugality continued with legal husband, then the relationship is sexual polyandry, and this is Michael Quinn's position, and this is why he was rather forceful in some emails of saying, Brian, you really need to talk about it. Third, though, if you assume that there was a plural sealing, and that sealing caused the civil marriage to be done away, and that the civil husband served as the front husband, then it's consecutive marriages, like we saw with Sylvia Sessions Lyon. So, take your pick, you know. But if we look at some of the observations, first, none of the leaders who heard Joseph B. Johnson's 1850 statement seemed concerned. There's just nothing there. John and Mary endured long periods apart after leaving Nauvoo. John and Mary stopped having children in 1833, either due to Mary's infertility or to an absence of sexual relations, because later, after Mary dies, John remarries and has children. Fourth, Mary dies in 52 and was not sealed to John Snyder during their lifetimes. They had several opportunities when they could have done it and didn't do it. This is evidence that she probably was sealed to somebody prior. And then John Snyder lived in Salt Lake City and remained a very devout member of the church throughout the rest of his life. He died in 75. So either he didn't know anything that's going on, or I think he knew everything that was going on, and it didn't seem to bother his testimony. So take your pick. What assumptions do you want to accept and which do you want to reject? Because of the lack of historical documentation, the exact nature of Joseph Smith's relationship with Mary Heron is indefinable currently. Hopefully we'll get some more information. Now, there's some contradictory evidence on this topic, and a lot of this is going to be new. One is that sexual polyandry is eyebrow-raising today. I mean, is there anybody here who doesn't think it's at least weird? In Illinois in the 1840s and afterwards, in Utah, it would have been scandalous. When asked in 1852, what do you think of a woman having more husbands than one? Brigham Young answered, this is not known in the law. 6 years later, Orson Pratt instructed that God is strictly forbidden in his Bible a plurality of husbands and proclaimed against it in his law. So when we run into these statements, and Nettie Corray Smith stated in 1860 that she'd heard Priscilla Huntington say afterwards in Utah that she did not know whether Mr. Buell, her legal husband, or the prophet was the father of her son. Or when we have anti-Mormon Ann Eliza Webb saying in 1875 that Zina Huntington had said that the greatest trial of her life was to live with her husband and Joseph too at the same time. Or anti-Mormon Sarah Pratt says in 1886 that Lucinda Pendleton said in 1841, why, I am Joseph Smith's mistress since 4 years. Now, there's lots of problems with each of these individual quotes, but these are the ones that everybody repeats, so I thought I'd bring them up here. But remember, in context, these women are declaring themselves as adulterous. That's the only way listeners could have interpreted these statements in that time, making them perhaps less plausible. It wasn't secret. In 1842, John C. Bennett published in his book, History of the Saints, the names of several of Joseph's wives, Mrs. Buell, Mrs. Durfee, Mrs. Sessions. So people knew that some of Joseph's wives had legal husbands. We can't just pass this off on secrecy. And yet, according to all available documents, Joseph Smith did not explicate it or defend it. No polyandrous wives personally reported it, defended it, or complained. No polyandrous husbands reported it, defended it, or complained. None of the officiators or witnesses reported it, defended it, or complained. Anti-Mormons did not complain until 1850, at least so far as I can find. Nobody's complaining about this really weird behavior and for 8 years after it reportedly began. 9 years. Now, it's easy to understand why a devout woman might not have complained, but it's less obvious why the participants would not have defended it had they been practicing. Undoubtedly, they would have been asked about it. Now, pointing out, you can't prove anything. Second, 20 months after the first polyandrous sealings and after dozens of people were aware of Joseph Smith's sealings to legally married women, he dictated Section 132 to explain why he had introduced plural marriage. And here's a chart. The first polyandrous sealing was in October of 41. I've plugged in some more names along here, but the last probably was in 1843. And then he dictates the revelation here. We don't have dates for all of these, but for probably 8 or 9 of them. Now, if Joseph Smith had been practicing sexual polyandry, he might have authorized that behavior in a verse in Revelation. Makes sense, right? Especially if he were just doing it based on libido, which is what so many people have portrayed. But instead, the Revelation describes at least 3 potentially polyandrous situations, all defined sexual polyandry as adultery. Third, throughout the 19th century, polyandry was a non-issue when discussing Joseph Smith's plural marriages. There were affidavit books written in 1869. We won't talk about it. But when you go through, this is the directory I put together. These are the polyandrous marriages. There's just no attempt to segregate them or anything. They're just there. They're just part of the mix. And then in the 1887 article by Andrew Jensen, Plural Marriage, again, we look at the testimonials, letters, affidavits that he cites in that article. There's just no attempt that I can detect, and maybe Todd will have other thoughts, but there's just no attempt to segregate them. Of the 27 wives named by Jensen, 9 are polyandrous. 5 were identified by their maiden names, 2 by their married names. Elvira A. Coles is inaccurately identified as afterwards the wife of Jonathan H. Holm, although there's some evidence to support that timeline. And then Ruth DeVos is identified as polyamorously as the wife of Edward Sayers, and nobody seems to be bothered by this. Now, the observation that polyamory was a non-issue in the 19th century could be explained several different ways, but one of them is that sexual polyamory was not practiced there. Fourth, in 1892, the RLDS Church claimed to be the successor to Joseph Smith's church and sued the Church of Christ Temple Lot to gain possession of the Independence, Missouri Temple site. Here it is. Here's the Stone Church. Here's the building by the Temple Lot Church, and then here's the Temple Lot. The Church of Christ Temple Lot sought to show that Joseph Smith taught and practiced full sexual polyandry, and since the RLDS Church did not, they were not the actual successors. The Utah LDS Church supported the Church of Christ Temple Lot and arranged for witnesses to testify of their polygamous relationships with the prophet. Now, the issue of sexual relations was paramount. Spiritual marriages, eternity-only seedlings, and unconsummated plural unions would have played right into the RLDS attorney's hands. Here's a directory if anybody's working with the Temple Lot transcript and wants a copy of this. It's going to be published. But at the time of the depositions in 1892, nine of Joseph Smith's plural wives were still living. The first plural wife that they called was Melissa Lott, and she testified of having carnal intercourse with Joseph. The second plural wife was Emily. Now, she lived right in Salt Lake City, and she also testified of having sexual relations with Joseph. Now, the respondents skipped all three of the polyandrous wives, and this is kind of a puzzler, because Zinah Huntington lived right in Salt Lake City. She lived just a few blocks from where they were taking the depositions. They also skipped Patty Bartlett, but she was 97, so we can probably figure out why they didn't ask her to come. But they also skipped Mary Elizabeth Rollins, who was in Ogden. She was well known to the brethren. Instead, they asked Lucy Walker, who lived 82 miles north, to come down, and Wilford Woodruff wrote her a letter personally and said, "Come on in." So she got on the train and went down to Salt Lake. And she also testified of sexual relations. And as a sidebar, this is interesting because Helen Mar Kimball, who also lived in Salt Lake City, and she wrote about their arrival, the Temple Lot attorneys. In fact, Todd transcribed some of that, but she knew about it, and they didn't ask her to come and testify of her sexual relations with Joseph Smith as a plural wife. But she was sealed at age 14. Now, maybe they ignored Zinah and Mary Elizabeth Rollins because they wanted to avoid the embarrassment generated by a testimony of polyamorous sexuality. I disagree, because 6 years later, Zinah agreed to be interviewed by John White, who was an RLDS elder. And he said to her, point blank, "Then it is a fact, is it not, that you married Mr. Smith at the same time you were married to Mr. Jacobs?" And Zinah responded, "What right do you have to ask such questions? I was sealed to Joseph for eternity." And then in 1905, Mary Elizabeth Rollins, responding to the same kind of question, said, "My husband, Adam Leitner, did not belong to the church. I begged and pled with him to join, but he would not. He said he did not believe in it, though he thought a great deal of Joseph. After he said this, I went forth and was sealed to Joseph for eternity." Now, both of these women in other places said they were sealed for time and eternity. But isn't it interesting, when point blank asked about their polyamorous relationships, they said they were sealed for eternity. Now, if we look at the history, some interesting thing pops out. The first report, John Bennett, 42. First complaint, 50, Arrowsmith. Every reference to multiple husbands for the next 100 years condemns it. We don't have time to read any of these, but everybody, members, leaders, condemn it. But then in 1945, Von Brody wrote that Joseph could, with a certain honesty, inveigh against adultery in the same week that he had slept with another man's wife, or indeed several men's wives, because he had imposed a very special marriage ceremony. So she essentially establishes it as undeniable in her book. And this is a sad chapter in Mormon history, because nobody comes forth to say, "Hey, Fawn, let's see your evidence about this polyandry stuff." Hugh Nibley responded to some of the polygamy charges, didn't touch polyandry, and I'm guessing nobody asked her for the evidence because they probably thought she had some. See, I think that she put an elephant in the front room of Mormon history. That elephant is that Joseph Smith practiced sexual polyandry, and nobody wanted to acknowledge it for decades. The first defense, well, in 1975, Dan Bachman wrote a thesis. It's an amazing work. Did an incredible job. No computers, 3x5 cards, amazing. But instead of taking his cue from this period and this, He takes his cue and leaves the door open for the possibility of sexual polyandry and everybody else's fault. I think now is the time for transparency on this issue to investigate whether the elephant is real or an inflatable decoy. Everybody thinks he did it anyway, so why not just let the evidence out there? And this is, I just threw this in last night, but you know, Fawn Brody treats Joe Smith like a comic book character, and everybody around him are clueless dupes. It's just not reality. I just have to vent for just a minute. I do not seek to prove that Joseph Smith did not practice sexual polyandry. He needs new slides, Todd, sorry. That's impossible to do. What I want to show, and I think it's something we can do, is that the evidence that supports it is less credible and less voluminous. The contradictory evidence is more credible and more voluminous. And that's all. That's all I can hope to show. And anybody can come along and show me wrong by producing some credible evidence. So this is an easy one for those who oppose me to show that I'm incorrect. You can say, well, why are people believing this if the evidence is not real strong and not real credible? Well, Richard Bushman said that polygamy is an interesting thing because it serves as a Rorschach test. People project onto Joseph Smith and the polygamist their own sense about human nature. Accordingly, most people readily assume that sexuality was involved. And then I'm going to quote myself, okay? Is that all right? The only people who can believe God commanded Joseph Smith to practice plural marriages are those who believe God was talking to him in the first place. Which isn't very many people who learn about this. In fact, most people are going to believe that he did it based on one of these two reasons. Assumption is going to fill the gap, and that arrow just keeps going. So, going back to my title, Joseph Smith's Sexual Polyandry and the Emperor's New Clothes, on closer inspection, what do we find? I think we find a lot of assumptions. Can't prove a negative. Those first two are sometimes cited as almost solid evidence that he did it. Assumption, you can't prove anything. There's no solid evidence, at least not that I found. Now, maybe Todd will produce something else, or somebody else will out there. But I'm saying, let's just bring it on. Let's talk about it. There's passionate convictions, and I've encountered those. And then I don't think anybody to date has accounted for Joseph Smith's teachings on polyandry or the contradictory evidence. I am told by Michael Quinn that he's producing an article with over 100 footnotes, and perhaps he'll do that. And I'm looking forward to that. And I'm hopeful if some editor decides to publish it, that they'll let me respond. So what happened in the 14 polyandrous marriages? Well, based upon the best assumptions, and I'm sorry I have to go there, but we all do, I think that these five were all eternity-only seedlings. These four husbands were not active LDS, and Albert Smith, the context of that marriage was that it was just eternity only. I skipped that part. And then we've got Windsor Lyon, and we've got Mary Heron, that I believe were ceilings, and the husbands, actually Windsor was absent. John Snyder is the big question mark, what do you want to assume? But I think he did serve as a front husband. We didn't talk about Sarah Ann Whitney or Joseph C. Kingsbury, but that's a very plain case of marrying her after she was sealed to Joseph and probably sexually involved with Joseph, and he was just a front husband. Now, there's six men and six more marriages that it's not real clear to me. These women may have chosen Joseph for eternity only. It's possible in these three, because we have two sealing dates for these women, that perhaps the first one was eternity only and the second one was time eternity. I'm speculating like crazy up here, but the evidence is just not available to know what's going on. And then there's a very dubious source here that states that Jonathan Holmes was approached by Joseph Smith to be a front husband. Late, dubious, and there's some other family things that support it, so I don't know. And then a bonus question is, why were almost all of Joseph Smith's plural marriages, his proposals, between April 5th, 1841 and April 9th, 1842, offered to legally married women? It's either 8 out of 9 or 11 out of 12, depending upon what you want to assume again. What's going on here? And then after he proposes to Nancy Rigdon, then there's only three or four more, and there's special cases, and all of the women after that are women who are not legally married and with whom we documented sexual relations in 12 of the cases and some ambiguous evidence for three more. Thank you.
Does turn the lights on.
Yeah, he's kidding.
I've been badly cutting my paper, Dan. It's a 30-page paper that will be published in the second volume of the Persistence of Polygamy series, being edited by Newell Greenhurst and Craig Foster. So, I'm trying to read really quickly. I'm trying to cut it down, but we'll see. That a number of Mormon plural wives were imprisoned during the late 19th century and became the focus of intense public controversy has been relegated to little more than a page or two or a footnote in modern Latter-day Saint histories. Between the years of 1882 and 1890, at least 11 plural wives were confined in the penitentiary. Many were taken into custody and placed on bond for their efforts to shield their polygamous husbands from conviction under anti-polygamy legislation. Their cases merit attention not only because their stories largely have been forgotten, but also because they occupy an often precedent-setting place in the history of the anti-polygamy legislative and judicial crusade and have revelatory value as barometers of public sentiment, both Mormon and non-Mormon. Further, they invite us to consider the problem of plural wives as agents within a patriarchal religious tradition and the competing narratives that often portray them as either heroic and autonomous or abused and victimized. Mormon plural wives were confined or placed on bond for a variety of polygamy-related offenses, including perjury, assaulting a federal officer, and fornication. Others were taken to the penitentiary to ensure their presence in the courtroom as witnesses in pending polygamy and unlawful cohabitation trials. However, the majority of plural wives who were incarcerated during this period were held in contempt of court. Most of them were not first and therefore lawful wives. As such, the court declared them competent witnesses and compelled them to testify against their accused spouses. When they refused, they were fined for contempt or incarcerated until the judge ordered their release. The grand jury under which they were being held was discharged, or they agreed to answer all questions deemed proper by the court. Though the LDS Church on Desert News found the possibility of indefinite and prolonged imprisonment harsh and extremely cruel, it was legal under federal law, the supposition being that the prisoner held the key to her liberty. She merely had to testify. The incarceration of plural wives employed as a tactic in the campaign against Mormon polygamy in the 19th century began in 1882 after the Edmunds Bill was passed by Congress and signed into law on 22 March of that year. Polygamy had been openly practiced in Utah for 30 years prior, the first 10 of which without federal legislative prohibition. The question as to whether Congress had the power to... I have lots of quotes in here for the sake of time. I'm not going to do quote unquote. Congress had the power to legislate the structure of domestic relations in the territories had been hotly debated in the 1850s because it was a legal category that in the 19th century included the law of master and servant as well as the law of husband and wife. It describes slavery as well as polygamy. The cyclical tension created by the desire to adhere to the law of land and what Mormons accepted as the law of God was relieved somewhat by the belief that the right to contract polygamous marriages was a religious practice protected by the First Amendment. Church leaders asserted that before any steps were taken in the direction of accepting the law, its constitutionality first had to be affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court. The 1862 Act, however, was unenforceable, and its constitutionality remained untested because no grand jury of their peers would indict Mormon leaders for obeying the commands of the religion. The impotence of the Morrell Act stimulated increased public opposition to the Mormons and their peculiar institution. During this period, Latter-day Saint polygamous marriage practices were almost universally denounced by those outside the faith. According to Sarah Barringer Gordon, anti-polygamy authors asserted that by, quote, undermining the distinctions between church and state and between church and home, Mormons jeopardized all three and led them into fundamental mistakes of belief and practice, of which polygamy was the most egregious and most telling. Further, the comparison of polygamy to slavery also highlighted the role of law in perpetuating both systems. Those vocally opposed to polygamy sought stringent federal oversight of territorial lands, clear and readily enforceable laws, and unequivocal punishment of wrongdoers, not only to protect monogamy in Utah, but also to send a message about the political value of Christian marriage to the rest of the nation. That's Gordon. However, the question of territorial sovereignty and the legislative and judicial means employed to eradicate plural marriage were much debated. By 1870, some suggested it was a menace sufficient to require a reorganization of the jury selection system, testos, by which prospective jurors were affirmed they neither practiced nor countenance polygamy, suspension of the statute of limitations, permission for a lawful wife to testify against her husband, confiscation of property without due process of law, abridgment of the right of local self-government, and threats of military intervention. Although none of these provisions was employed immediately, most were later enacted in the anti-polygamy, as the anti-polygamy crusade gained momentum. I've got to skip a lot, so I'll just mention the Poland Act passed in 1874, and one of the most important things it did was it liberated the judicial process in the territory from Mormon control. So the George Reynolds case left, and then the George Reynolds case in 1879, where it was brought before the U.S. Supreme Court, left the Mormons without a legal or constitutional protection for the practice of polygamy. Federal law enforcement officials remained somewhat exasperated by the secrecy of Mormon marriage ceremonies, which made it nearly impossible to catch or convict an alleged polygamist unless his plural wife admitted to the marriage. Proving a second or a third or fourth marriage in a jurisdiction that had no official registration provisions, in a church that purportedly kept no records of marriages, and in the midst of a recalcitrant population, asserts Gordon, was a burden prosecutors could not meet. As a test case, Reynolds was both indispensable and insufficient. In March 1882, the Edmonds Act was bill was enacted, and it was the first broadly effective anti-polygamy legislation. Reacting to the passage of the Edmonds Bill, LDS President John Taylor, speaking at a church conference the following April, called the law oppressive and asserted, "We will contend inch by inch, legally and constitutionally, for our rights as American citizens." A few months thereafter, occurred, according to Orson F. Whitley, quote, "a sensational episode which, though isolated from the long series of raids and prosecutions that followed, was a precursor of what was approaching and gave some of the tactics that would be employed by the Crusaders. This pivotal event was the imprisonment of Annie Gallivan, a plural wife of John Connolly, for contempt of court." Give a sort of great deal of information on Gallivan and for the first few cases, and then I'll have to skip over a number of the others. On 17 November 1882, the office of the pregnant Gallivan was brought before the grand jury in Salt Lake City and asked questions designed to indict her reputed polygamous husband. During the proceedings, she admitted she was married and had, quote, never been married but once. Lots of quotes here again. One question wrote the Salt Lake Herald, a Salt Lake Herald reporter. She answered that it was foolish and she would not reply. To another, she made an evasive response, and to some other, she emphatically refused to make any reply whatsoever. Gallivan was then taken before a judge, John A. Hunter, of the Third District Court. She gave no reason for refusing to answer and did not claim that she had incriminated herself. Hunter affirmed the questions were proper and instructed her to answer or face fine and imprisonment. She indicated she still did not intend to answer, at which time the court ordered her confined until she consented to answer the questions put to her. The Deseret News noted that Gallivan was then placed in custody. Though her confinement there lasted only one night, the case, according to the Deseret News, created much indignation among people of various shades of opinion in the city. It is the first time in the history of Utah, reported the Ogden Daily Herald, wherein a lady like Mrs. Annie Gallivan was interrogated by a grand jury in regard to her social status and her private marital relations. Because she refused to answer, the Herald continued, she was dragged before a United States court and by it sent to the penitentiary there to remain until she was willing to answer any and every question the grand jury might find proper to pose upon her. We think, to put it mildly, so quoting, the grand jury committed an inexcusable blunder in pushing the matter before the court, and that the dignitary greatly erred in reducing the witness to such degrading alternative. The Deseret News also expressed its indignation. Here's a lady far advanced in a condition described as that which ladies love to be who love their lords. Hurried before 15 men without a friend to accompany her, give her advice, questioned upon her condition and social status until she refused to answer further, hauled into court and without any opportunity to obtain counsel or communicate with her friends, committed to be imprisoned in the penitentiary until she would comply with the demands of the grand jury. Reporting her release the following day, the news stated the grand jury has been discharged and as there is no inquisition to put her on the rack, she cannot be called upon to answer the questions propounded. The comparison of such proceedings to the Inquisition appeared throughout sympathetic accounts of female contempt cases. Galifant's baby was born 4 days following her release. Other than reporting the general facts of the Galifant case, the Salt Lake Tribune remained editorially mute. However, a detailed grand jury investigation of the prison facilities and, perhaps in anticipation, concluded the account with the following. There are no provisions whatever made for female prisoners, a want which it seems to us should be supplied at once. 6 months later, the imprisonment of another poor wife forced officials to act on the Tribune's suggestion. Perhaps the most celebrated and well-documented contempt case involving a plural wife was that of Belle Harris. As a young woman, the attractive, intelligent Harris was under perpetual censure for reading novels. Her brother claimed this contributed to her romantic musings and disappointment when her family moved from Parowan, Southern Utah's civic and religious center at the time, to 160 acres of river bottom land in Sevier County, where her only suitors were cowboys and sheep herders, quoting from her, most of whom wore beards that were dangerously near being gray. It was not surprising, therefore, that when the charming and urbane Clarence Merrill chanced by on a stagecoach bound for Salt Lake City, the romantically minded Harris was smitten. She was 17, he 38, and married to LDS Apostle Georgie Smith's daughter, Bathsheba. Harris and Merrill were sealed in St. George during the summer of 1879. As it turned out, Merrill deposited her on a remote ranch and did not adequately support her with their child, born in 1881. During his frequent and extended absences, she struggled to provide for herself and the child and soon became exasperated. Quote, the work was hard, but I did not mind that, she wrote. It was the utter futility of it all that I could not stand. She requested an interview with Apostle John Henry Smith, who advised her, though pregnant with her second child, to end the marriage to Merrill. The divorce was signed by President John Taylor in the spring of 1882. Soon after her second child was born, law enforcement officials, assuming she would provide evidence against her ex-husband and thereby open the way for similar indictments, subpoenaed her to appear before the grand jury of the Second District Court in Beaver, which she did the following spring. On 17 May 1883, Harris was held in contempt as a witness before the grand jury by Judge Stephen P. Twist for refusing to answer a question regarding her alleged ex-husband. Although the judge deemed the question proper, she said her, quote, marriage is a matter for which this grand jury has no concern, and as such such question is improper, I will not answer it. Twist accordingly fined her $25 and committed her to the custody of the U.S. Marshal to be taken to the penitentiary until she agreed to testify or the grand jury was dismissed. That the grand jury did not adjourn until 29 August 1883 guaranteed at least a 3 month stay in the penitentiary for Harris and her nursing baby unless her lawyer secured a writ of habeas corpus from the Utah Territorial Supreme Court. Harris, her baby, she left a penitentiary diary, and so I thought it might be interesting to quote extensively from that so you'll get a sense of what of the experience. Harris, her baby, and 8 other male prisoners arrived at the penitentiary in Salt Lake City on 18 May 1883. Harris recorded the events in her penitentiary diary. Having completed the 220-mile trip without eating or sleeping, she felt faint and weary. She found the penitentiary a gloomy place and noted, it was some time before I could compose myself, sufficiently to attend to the wants of my baby, who was sick and tired. Within hours of her arrival, she was visited by such prominent female LDS leaders as Emmeline B. Wells, Isabella Horn, Ellen C. Clausen, and Crescentia L. Kimball. They brought her tempting delicacies and offered to furnish her every comfort she required. She was placed in the trustee's dining room, given a sleeping lounge blanket and pillows, and made as comfortable as possible until other arrangements could be made. She ended the diary and counted the day with the following. When all was quiet, I was permitted to lock my door from within and retire to rest. Here I sat all night long with my baby in my arms. Desolation engulfed me. Throughout her stay in the penitentiary, her case inspired lengthy commentary, locally and nationally, by both Mormon and non-Mormon press. Predictably, the news dubbed her a martyr, showering her with sympathy, while at the same time attacking their counterparts at non-Mormon publications. In turn, the Salt Lake Tribune criticized the news, supporting the actions of the court and discrediting both Harris and her ex-husband. An early news story described Harris as a lady with a nursing infant, forcibly separated from her other child, torn from her home in Monroe, Sevier County, put in a lumber wagon, hauled to the penitentiary, refusing to answer a privileged question, with reference to herself and not in relation to her knowledge of an alleged crime. It further quoted from an article in the Sacramento Record Union, which asserted that the grand jury was not under necessity of totally relying on this woman's testimony. The article then asked, why was it necessary to plunge Belle Harris into prison and refuse her bail in order to ascertain who is the father of her children? The woman has exhibited courage in a bad cause that nevertheless excited respect coupled with pity. We fear our Gentile friends in Utah lack discretion in their zeal. In response, the Tribune printed the following. Our contemporary, the news, was sadly out of humor last evening. It tried with desperate recklessness to make out by the case of Belle Harris that the U.S. officials are vindictive toward Mormons. In the case of Belle Harris, the officers have no discretion. She was ordered into confinement for contempt of court in refusing to answer necessary questions. Those questions, the news declared, are questions of privilege. They were questions which the court doubtless thought it was a privilege to ask. And the answer being refused, His Honor took the privilege of sending the woman to the penitentiary. At this, the news is wrathy beyond expression. How am I on time? Half? The news answered a later Tribune claim that Harris's confinement was necessary to preserve the dignity of the court by comparing her case to others in which non-Mormon criminals were released on bail, particularly noting the case of a Dr. Carrington who was accused of bigamy and liberated. How much is society protected by the incarceration of a woman who merely declined to satisfy the impertinent curiosity of a prying lawyer in regard to her private affairs, the news asked, and how much is it protected by the liberation of violators of virtue and marriage vows, irredeemers, burglars, and bloodletters? As agitation increased over the Harris case, articles appeared almost daily. Harris continued to record her experiences in her diary. The dining room of the prison was an inconvenient place to house the female prisoner, and so plans were soon made to build a room for her. Her days were marked by the frequent visits of her father, friends, and new sympathetic acquaintances. These visitors brought food, books, paper, playthings for the baby, clothing, a sewing machine, material, furniture for her room, and monetary donations for Mormons and non-Mormons throughout the territory. Still, life in prison was monotonous and especially uncomfortable during the summer months. Both Harris and her baby were frequently sick and fretful. The days dragged on, particularly when prison ward Dow, in an effort to make the place seem more like a prison, shortened the length of allowed visits to 30 minutes and ordered Harris locked in her room, except for 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon. With this new order came speculation about who would have the key. Four or five guards proposed carrying it. The warden indicated he would let his wife take charge of it, but Harris noted, I do not believe he will. He did. Occasionally, Harris was taunted by the guards. She claimed some told her that she need not think of leaving the prison for 2 years at least. I told them that was all nonsense, she wrote. At other times, friendly jailers were forbidden to speak to her. I suppose the marshal thinks that this will make me feel so badly I will surrender immediately, she reported, though likely I did not come here to be entertained by any of the guards, and therefore shall not feel to lament a great deal. I believe that if this absurdity is carried much farther, they will become disgusted themselves, for the dullest and most perverse cannot fail to see the utter folly and wickedness of such an uncalled for and unlawful outrage. On 24 May, Marshall Greenman and Mr. Putnam visited her. Harris reported that Putnam expressed his sympathy, for he knew that I was persuaded by others to act as I was doing, and that I never would go into plurality again. I told him I supposed he had a right to his own opinion regarding the matter. I could meet in the vowed enemy, she added, but a wolf in sheep's clothing I do despise. During a similar interview with a marshal Ireland, she was told that her situation and treatment would have been quite different had she not answered the grand jury's questions for fear of incriminating herself. Harris became increasingly anxious at the date of the territorial Supreme Court review of her petition for release during the year. On 21 June, she summarized a conversation she had with Warden Dow. Although Dow told her he thought her lawyer should be shot if she was not released, Harris wrote, "He did not say what he thought of the men who put me here, but he said it was a fearful thing that people would believe in a religion that could possibly get them into this place. He does not understand our religion nor the persecution we have to put up with." Her case was put on advisement. The tension of waiting the court's decision was compounded the next day by the fact that Harris was forced to share her quarters at the penitentiary with another female prisoner, a non-Mormon, and her child. Ironically, the woman, a Mrs. P. Humphreys, whom Harris never mentions by name and to whom she only refers to as the woman, was arrested for bigamy, she being the bigamist. Humphreys was described by Harris as, quote, one of the lowest class Lisiacs I've ever known so far. "Oh, I feel that it is more than I can bear to be shut up with a common prostitute and be obliged to eat at the same table. I had a good cry last night." Her reaction to Humphreys is somewhat predictable. Plural wives were often viewed by those outside the LDS community as nothing more than glorified prostitutes or concubines. That Harris would want to quash any association with Humphreys is not surprising. Humphreys released on 12 July 1883 delighted Harris. Harris was not released. She wrote a letter to the News expressing her shock at having to remain in prison for at least 2 more months. The News published an accompanying editorial. "A vindictive and extreme course has been taken from the beginning in this case, and it will fail in its object. Belle Harris looks up as a victim to legal impudence and judicial harshness, and the consequences will not be such as were desired by the lawyers or the judges." Harris's lawyers began to draw papers for her to agree to comply as a last resort. However, Harris refused to consider the compromise. Harris' continued confinement prompted increased curiosity. She was visited by a reporter from the Eastern paper, and although she claimed to shut notoriety and became indignant when she caught reporters peeking through the window of her quarters, Harris seemed to enjoy pairing with the press. She admitted that she looked forward to receiving newspapers and seeing how her conduct was received by reporters, editors, and people in general. Although she thought the Tribune an abominable sheet and found it trying to listen to the abuse heaped upon the Latter-day Saints and especially the presidency of the church. A month or so before Harris was released, she reported to the News a conversation she had with prosecuting attorney Zara Snow that documents an attempt to compel her to testify by the threat of prolonged imprisonment. The report, I'll leave it at that. The Tribune attacked the News editorial. It found it odd that the News never referred to its Mormon martyr as Mr. or Mrs., yet claimed she properly refused to answer the question of who her husband was. "What lady outside of Utah or Turkey," it quit, "being surrounded by her children, asked such a question and refused to answer. We caution the Mormon people not to be too certain that Belle Harris demands unusual sympathy," the article continues. "The News boasts of its unswerving loyalty to the United States as well as of its own perfect non-combative piety. The country has been blessed with many humorists during the past 25 years, but there is not such another one as in the Union as the News editor." On 31 August 1883, the grand jury under which Harris was held was discharged. She could be held no longer. Immediately after her release, Harris was hailed as a heroine within the Mormon community and met with parties, crowds, and celebrations from Salt Lake City to Provo. A short time later, she returned to Monroe and was not subpoenaed again. Prosecutions for polygamy proceeded slowly while Congress waited for the Utah... They proceeded slowly. They were waiting for the Utah legislature to pass conformity legislation, which it did not for a number of reasons. On 23 May, the Tribune reported, "Another martyr, Nellie White, is destined to take a prominent stand beside the far-famed Belle Harris in the field of Utah female martyrdom. She has defied the grand jury in the United States District Court, and in the eyes of the average Mormon, that is sufficient to make her immortal." And indeed, she was immortalized, not only in the Mormon Press, but also in the Tribune. Millie White, alleged photo wife Gerard Roundy, was subpoenaed and sworn as a witness before the grand jury attached to the police report. And I'm going to read some of the questions that were asked her. Have you ever gone through a rite of ceremony of marriage with Gerard Roundy? Are you his wife in clear marriage? Are the relations existing between yourself and Gerard Roundy those of husband and wife? Do you decline to answer because it is a fact that you are his wife or not so? Have you ever been in the endowment house? Do you know who are the officiating priests or officers in the endowment house? She refused to answer all of the foregoing on the grounds that they were not proper questions and was ordered to appear before Judge Hunter. After Judge Hunter signed and read the jury's report, the Tribune reported that he turned to White and said, Mrs. Roundy, will you please stand up? White remained seated, her eyes saying, you can't catch me that way. White, when he referred to her as Millie White, she stood looking, quote, the personification of defiance. The judge informed her that the questions were proper, and she remained willing to answer. She was thereupon ordered to confine to the penitentiary. After the proceedings, White talked freely with the Tribune reporter. She is quite a fluent conversationalist, he reported. Refined in her manners, and a woman upon one man might well lavish his whole love instead of one third. During the interview, White spoke lightly about her predicament. When asked if she could stand to be imprisoned as long as Belle Harris, she replied, "Oh, I think I can. I can stand it as long as they can. It won't be much harder for me to be confined in a penitentiary than it is in a schoolroom." A schoolroom is a sort of jail anyhow. Later, she became somewhat more reflective. Commenting on the questions put to her by the grand jury, she said, "I was surprised that so many intelligent men as composed that jury would try to confuse and question me, a lone woman, as they did. I'm no coward and they'll find it out. They can't frighten us Mormon women, and it's no use for them to try to do it. What harm have I done to anybody? If we believe polygamy is necessary for the salvation of our souls and think it is a religious duty to go into it, whose business is it? I'd like to know. If a husband and wife agree to another wife, that another wife shall be taken into the family, and a young girl agrees to become that wife, and views such a marriage as a matter of salvation and religious duty, do you think it wrong or anybody's business to interfere with the arrangement?" These questions, wrote the Tribune, coming from a woman of more than ordinary intelligence, rather disgusted the reporter, and preferring not to argue the question of the desirability of concubinage or the religious right of prostitution, the interview came to an abrupt termination. At the penitentiary, White, unlike Harris, was not permitted to receive any articles of food or comfort. And when White was released on 7 July 1884, the News commended Judge Hunter for doing what it considered to be the proper thing in discharging a body, the grand jury, whose existence was only continued for the purpose of prolonging the imprisonment, I'm quoting from the Tribune, of a woman who could not be made to talk as desired. Roundy was not indicted. From the latter part of 1884 until the manifesto ostensibly ending plural marriage in 1890, prosecutions for polygamy and unlawful cohabitation proceeded vigorously. Skip most of these, the cases. During this time, there was a significant gearing up of the judicial machinery. The Tribune noted in the previous contempt cases in the territory how inadequate the punishment had been and how effectively the wheels of justice had been blocked by the refusal of witnesses in these cases to testify before the grand jury. I want to just quickly mention the case of Lydia Spencer, because unlike the previous cases, Spencer was subpoenaed to testify in an actual trial and not a grand jury proceeding. Therefore, the judge had the power to imprison the witness indefinitely under the Special Practice Act of 1874. And the judge cautioned that he said, you take a fearful responsibility undertaking to defy the government. You stand as a criminal before the law. It is your duty to testify, and you must testify or take the consequences. If you are not ready to determine now, think about it by morning. Think about it seriously. Remember, you become a criminal in the estimation of the law. Anyway, Spencer chose to remain silent. She was confined to the penitentiary for one night, where she received a communication from her husband advising her to take the oath and to state the full truth. Spencer testified the following day, and Clausen was found guilty on both counts of the indictment, pleading an unlawful cohabitation. The Tribune added insult to the blow dealt the Mormons. It claimed that it had, had the former rule been in effect, Spencer only would have been threatened with a few months of imprisonment for contempt. Clausen would have never been, they're quoting the Tribune, would never have been anxious about the matter, and every high priest in the church would, if necessary, have perjured his soul to defeat justice in this case, end quote. Thereafter, contempt of court became a grave threat in polygamy cases where an indictment was obtained and the case brought to trial. So, anyway, there were several other women who were imprisoned later. Their cases are similar in that they were all found in contempt during grand jury proceedings, fined, imprisoned in the penitentiary, and later released on bond pending future grand jury or court proceedings. It seems, as I said, indicting, sending, putting women in the penitentiary never been thought of that. Let me just go on. I have to cut this. Prosecutions for polygamy and unlawful cohabitation skyrocketed in 1886 and 1887, although a few women, such as Matilda Lunstedt, were held in the penitentiary to ensure their presence in the courtroom as witnesses impending polygamy and unlawful cohabitation trials. No plural wives were imprisoned for contempt during this time. It appears that as convictions for unlawful cohabitation became easier to obtain, the futility and discomfort of imprisonment discouraged women from refusing to comply. Two plural wives were often encouraged by their husbands to testify in order to avoid confinement. Others followed President John Taylor's advice and went underground. An increasingly successful judiciary also seemed more inclined to place the few women found in contempt under bond rather than in the penitentiary. Given that there was little space to house female prisoners, and the incarceration of women and their dependent children always sparked controversy. The underlying assumption behind anti-polygamy legislation from 1862 to 1887 was that plural marriage was barbaric and should be eradicated. By 1887, however, legislators concluded that since it was practiced by Mormons, the entire Mormon enterprise was evil and should be broken. The Edmunds-Tucker Act was a result. I don't have time to tell you. For plural wives, what the Edmunds-Tucker Act meant was it was clear and devastating. Fornication, adultery, and the revocation of women's suffrage brought women as well as men into the criminal and political focus of federal law. Between 1887 and 1890, pregnant women in polygamous marriages were targeted by federal officials. Although 188 indictments for fornication were brought against Mormon plural wives, none was imprisoned, and most cases were not pursued beyond indictment and arraignment. There were three more cases of contempt under the new legislation prior to the old age, which is public renunciation of polygamy. And in the last case, which is Hester Hendrickson, on 18 January 1889, the news reported that although Hendrickson consented to comply after 6 days of imprisonment, she does not recede from the legality of her position. She simply yields under extreme pressure. There is no proper place, the news continued, in which to confine females in the penitentiary. An imagination may but faintly depict the mental and physical agony that would be endured by a delicate and respectable woman. The following year, under extreme legislative and judicial pressure, the LDS Church also yielded. Though its compliance with anti-polygamy legislation was not immediate, the issuance of the manifesto signaled the demise of the controversial practice within the LDS Church. I have about a page and a half of sort of, I'm going to do a major shift here to sort of a little bit of feminist theory, and so bear with me and I'll be done. There is a tendency in the discourse surrounding Mormon plural wives to see them either as heroic, autonomous agents or victims of an oppressive religious tradition. This is particularly true of, but not confined to, the 19th century polemics in the cases examined here. Both narratives are problematic. The former fails to recognize the very real constraints on women's agency within a patriarchal polygamous community, while the latter insists that women can only demonstrate agency by resisting the norms of such a community. The cases involving the women in this study highlight this dichotomy. At one level, writes Sarah Berenger Gordon, the requirement that they appear in court to testify about the intimate details of their married lives threatened their very self-identity as respectable women of the 19th century. Most important, however, the actions of these women, who were courageous from the perspective of their co-religionists but contemptible to outsiders, challenged their status as passive victims. It was startling to 19th century suffragists that Mormon women, empowered for over a decade with the right to vote, did not use it to eradicate polygamy. By the mid-1880s, Gordon continues, Mormon women were revealed as active participants in the perpetuation of polygamy. They could hardly be treated as innocent victims. To federal officials and to many anti-polygamists, Mormon women required punishment as well as pity, unquote. Their physical and verbal invasiveness, going underground, committing perjury, conveniently forgetting, and refusing to testify, transformed Mormon women in the eyes of their anti-polygamy contemporaries, quoting from Gordon, from victims into moral agents. Contemporary feminist scholars wrestle with the problem of agency within conservative religious traditions. Since resistance to patriarchal norms is generally equated with agency, women's acts that sustain traditional religions are not viewed as constituting agency. Drawing on the work of Saba Mahmood, Amy Hoyt suggests that agency can be evident both in resisting and maintaining norms within a community, though she admits it's often difficult to locate autonomy when one is compliant. While recognizing the limits of religious and cultural expectations and boundaries, Hoyt posits that agency often includes a simultaneous spectrum of behaviors that fall between the poles of autonomy and limited freedom. The right to vote, as well as their sanctioned participation in the public discourse in defense of polygamy, politicized Mormon women in 19th century Utah. Through mass meetings and the publication of suffragist periodicals, Mormon plural lives constructed a narrative of women's rights that went beyond what male church leaders might have expected. It was a narrative that resisted the traditional monogamous norms of American society, which relegated women primarily to the private sphere, and embraced a patriarchal polygamous pattern, which stunningly accommodated a more expansive public role for women. Perhaps Mahmood is right. The question for scholars may not be how Mormon women freed themselves from the norms of a religion that many see as oppressive, but how they simultaneously inhabited and subverted the norms of 19th century Mormonism.
Okay, first I'll respond to Brian's paper. First of all, Brian deserves enormous credit for taking on this issue. He has pointed out how the problem of Joseph Smith marrying women legally married to other men, which I refer to as polyandrous for convenience, so that term has been disputed by Larry Foster on technical grounds. Anyway, this issue has been taboo among conservative Mormons for a long time. And Brian is a very thorough researcher and has done his homework with both primary and secondary documents. He and Don Bradley have done wonderful work with the Andrew Jensen papers, a collection I did not have access to when I researched in Sacred Mormon. His forthcoming book will be a landmark in the historiography of Mormon polygamy as the first thorough examination of Joseph Smith's polygamy from an LDS writer who is somewhat in the conservative mainstream. There are many Mormons out there, and many of them in the structure of the institutional church, who would prefer that the subject of Joseph's polygamy would continue to be taboo and avoided by historians. And there are a lot of new significant details about Joseph Smith's polygamy that are appearing in Brian's research. And one of them is the extremely important information that Flora Woodworth married non-Mormon Carlos Gove on August 23, 1843, when Joseph Smith was still alive. And in my book, I followed a statement by Helen R. Whitney that Flora married Carlos Gove after Joseph's death. So that's a very significant fact that will make us reinterpret her whole life history from that point on. And I'm starting to wonder, I'm just starting to take this in, I'm wondering if she married Gove secretly. But at this point, it's totally speculation, but whatever. It's an insignificant fact. Having said all these positive things, I disagree with him on some issues, and certainly on the main subject under discussion here, as Brian notes in the paper. I think for marriage in Joseph Smith's culture, sexuality and childbearing was such an accepted part of the institution that the burden of proof is on anyone who maintains that any particular marriage did not include sexuality. LDS plural marriages in the 19th century generally included sexuality and childbearing. I don't think there is anything especially controversial or antagonistic about expecting sexual relations to be part of a marriage. They are a normal, positive part of the great majority of marriages. So Brian, in positing that the majority of Joseph Smith's polyandrous marriages were for eternity only and did not include sexual relations, is taking on a very imposing, difficult burden of proof. So I accept one woman, Ruth Bowles Sayers, as married to Joseph for an apparent eternity-only marriage. And both Brian and I have talked about that in more detail elsewhere. As we saw in one slide, some of Joseph's polyandrous wives said they were married to Joseph for eternity. But, as Brian mentioned, they also said they were married to him for time. We can either look at this as conflicts in their testimony or as the woman emphasizing different parts of a time and eternity marriage. And I lean toward this interpretation. They were time and eternity marriages. And in some cases, they emphasized the eternity, but the time aspect was always there. The main evidence against Brian's overarching theory is the case of Sylvia Sessions, a polyandrous wife who had a child, Josephine, who was accepted by Sylvia, Josephine, and other Mormon polygamy insiders as a child of Joseph Smith. To deal with this case, Brian posits that Sylvia was divorced from her first husband, Winsor Lyon. She then married Joseph and had Josephine, who was raised as Josephine Lyon. Then, after Joseph's death, Sylvia remarried Winsor. This is a complex argument, and you need to read it in detail in Brian's paper on Sylvia in Mormon History Studies, or on his website. However, in my view, there is no definite evidence for this divorce, to my knowledge. This is such an important case that some positive evidence for a clear-cut divorce would be necessary, I think. Some of the evidence Brian presents for Mormons not emphasizing polyandrous marriages can be subjected to entirely different interpretation than the one he uses. For example, I agree with him that it is very significant that none of the polyandrous wives were called to testify at the Temple Loss trial. But I believe that Joseph's polyandrous marriages have already become a taboo subject. And the case of Sylvia Sessions and Josephine Lyon Fisher were well known to church leaders. And a descendant of Sylvia and Josephine has told me that Joseph F. Smith would invite Josephine Lyon Fisher to Smith family reunions. So they knew it was entirely possible that polyandrous marriages included sexuality, and I think that would motivate them to shield the polyandrous marriages from further scrutiny. And in the interest of time, I will end that response there. Okay, for Laurie's paper, this offers an introduction to women in prison for conscience' sake as part of the polygamy persecutions in the 1880s. While there has been a lot of emphasis on men serving time in the state pen for cohabitation, this article shows that women also were imprisoned, and it gives a fascinating view of the legal reasons for their imprisonment and their experiences as prisoners. And it also raises the complex issue of how we should view this story from a feminist perspective. So this article will be a great contribution to the Bringhurst Foster multi-volume polygamy series that they're editing. For me, this paper offers a very complex story ethically. For us today in the legal battle between Mormon polygamists and moral crusaders from the East, who are the good guys and who are the bad guys? And of course, the Republican Party, known for getting rid of slavery, which is one of the great moral steps in American history, they were also the crusaders against polygamy. Okay, so how do we look at this as Mormons? And how do we look at the women caught in this system? It seems like they're being used in this chess game between the Mormons and the anti-Mormons and the legal system. One of the patterns that I've noticed in my research is a man married a plural wife. For various reasons, he decides not to have this woman live close to him. And often he visits her infrequently, and frequently enough that she has children, but then she's raising them alone in difficult circumstances. To me, this is an abusive situation, which is possible under polygamy, but would not occur in monogamy. So I am definitely, for this and other reasons, I'm not a cheerleader for 19th century Mormon polygamy. It was problematic in many ways that were systemic within the institution, I believe. And so that's exactly the situation that Bell, Harris, and Merrill undergoes, as Laurie has explained. So given this situation and her divorce from her husband, non-Mormons thought they had a slam dunk in getting her to testify against her deadbeat ex-husband. But she refused to and even endured imprisonment rather than testify. And I believe it was because of her loyalty to her people, her church leaders. It wasn't necessarily because she was a cheerleader for polygamy. She had a very bad experience. I mean, but she was loyal to her culture, her people. And so I end up with mixed feelings on this story. I deeply admire women like Bell. On the other hand, I view polygamy as a flawed marriage system, and when the LDS Church finally gave it up, I believe it was a step forward for the Church. And in the interest of time, we'll skip the rest. Oh, I have a few suggestions for polishing. I'd like a little more explanation on how different women have seen women as heroic and autonomous, or abused and victimized. And Laurie might fit that into the ending, talking a little bit more about these specific women in this case. Also, I would like a little more family history on each of these women, especially the number of wives and the families, and just a little bit about what happened to them and their husbands after imprisonment. Of course, if you start down that rabbit hole, you might end up writing a book. Okay, so be careful. Thank you.
Go ahead.
You don't mention anything about taking the Fifth Amendment. Were they available to take the Fifth Amendment?
Well,
do you want to repeat that in the mic and then just quickly answer it?
In some ways, that would assume they refused to incriminate. You know what I mean? That would say they would be incriminating themselves, and they refused to answer any of those things. Plus, it was a grand jury proceeding. So, I need lawyers in the audience? No?
Laurie, do you have access to any lawyers?
I do.
Know
I sleep with a lawyer. Yeah. Do you? Can you take the Fifth? Yeah. I don't. Can you take the Fifth in a grand jury proceeding?
I really have never had experience with grand jury, so I don't know for sure. The Fifth Amendment allows you a privilege from incriminating yourself. So I would think that it would apply in a grand jury proceeding also. But were the women being prosecuted, I guess, if the women weren't being prosecuted...
They were witnesses.
Yeah, they were witnesses. So they weren't incriminating themselves by testifying if there was no threat of prosecution to them anyway. Now, if there was a threat of prosecution, then they could take the Fifth. And you cannot assume that somebody is guilty because they take the Fifth. I mean, that's why
right.
we have the Fifth.
Right.
So I don't know the answer as far as the grand jury is concerned, except to say that the Fifth Amendment is a right against self-incrimination, no matter what your setting is, I would think. Even though I don't have it.
Is that microphone on? Can you tell?
It does not.
Probably not. Just speak loud and we can repeat the question. I'd just like to ask, Lori, just a quick question. Is there going to be any kind of a chart in your chapter that would list the women, how long they were in jail, what the charge, anything. I can just visualize that. I'm kind of that way. I like PowerPoints and things like that. Is there any way you can visualize or in a chart anything
possibly
like that? Would that be too extensive?
I see. It would just require me to do a lot more work. Yeah, there were only 11 of them, and I detail the other cases. Would it be helpful to have something like that, a chart? Oh, okay.
I don't want to cause any more work, but I think it would be so neat to visualize that. I'm interested, too. You aren't going to go past 1890, I understand.
No.
And that's fine. What was the average stay? How long were they in?
Not very long.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. Compared to the men, it was very short.
It was
anyway,
very
things
short.
Like that might be of interest. Okay, another question?
Yes, this question is directed mostly to Todd and Brian. Relative to the polyandrous marriages wherein Joseph Smith had relations with those wives, it seems that the husbands, their existing husbands, their first husbands, acquiesced to that arrangement. I don't see any protest. I'm very familiar with the Sylvia Sessions Windsor-Lyon marriage, and I don't see any real protest or controversy related to that from the first husband's perspective. Do you have any thoughts on why they seem to acquiesce to that type of an arrangement?
You want to repeat the question? And just quickly, is how many first husbands acquiesced to Joseph Smith marrying their wife?
I think you're going to get two different answers. Do you want his answer or my
answer? Yeah, I
might have
both answers.
I think each polyandrous marriage was a different situation. And it's impossible to generalize too much from any specific situation. And they're very different. Like Miranda Hyde married Joseph when her husband was far away, you know, so he didn't have anything to say about it, you know, until he came home. And some of these the first husbands were non-Mormons, antagonistic, like Buell, who married Presendia, his first husband of Presendia, Kimball, later Kimball. And so I would think that he would have known that. Sometimes there's some evidence in family history that someone like Henry Jacobs did know that. So I think in some cases the husband might have known about it and acquiesced to it.
As far as the evidence goes, this is why I keep harping on evidence, but there is no case where we have good evidence of a woman sleeping with both husbands at the same time. We assume she's sleeping with her legal husband, but in the two or three cases where we have some evidence that she is having sexual relations with Joseph, we don't have good evidence of sexual relations. And Todd and I disagree with Sylvia on Sylvia, but there is no good evidence that she's also cohabiting with her legal husband. There's only three that I showed on my chart. And when you go beyond that, you're just into the realm of assuming and what you're willing to assume and what you're not. And there's some new evidence that I don't know if Todd's seen from the Andrew Jensen papers that, again, pushes the relationship with Joseph after she had separated from Windsor, which, again, I argue is not sexual polyandry. And then in the other two cases, the one of Mary Heron is the one where we just don't know. Why would he acquiesce? And he didn't remarry for years. You know, they could have gone out and got a plural wife. He didn't do it. That's a puzzler. But the third one that I talked about is just the front husband, and there was no sex there. So I don't think it really happened. It may be enough to really talk about it.
Hi. I have two questions for Brian. My name is Michelle. I haven't reached a conclusion about sexual polyandry, so I'm not going to argue with you on that. But I am curious about how you were using Dr. Nick Upman's 132. It was about adultery, and I'm curious if you remind me what verse it is so I can find it.
Yeah, the verses 61 through 63 talk about if a virgin is espoused in this law of the priesthood, And then if she be with another man, she's committed adultery and shall be destroyed. But you'll have to read through because it jumps to another topic, 61 through 63. And then there's a very interesting verse 41. And we don't have time to talk about it. It could take probably 15 minutes. But it's an interesting verse because it doesn't tell us two things about what's going on. It just tells us a scenario, but two things are missing. And verse 42 states very plainly that if a woman is married to a man but not in the new and everlasting covenant, if she be with another man, she's committed adultery. So that's really plain. If a woman's legally married and then she sleeps with another guy, that's adultery. And, of course, we would accept that.
Well, I've had a different, an alternate interpretation of that. I've interpreted that if she's sealed in one marriage and if she's with someone else without being sealed to that person, it's adultery. So I didn't interpret that as being against polyandry. Does that make sense? As a possibility?
Well, if you read verse 63, it just says, if she be with another man. There's no asterisk saying if it's a legal husband or a sealed husband. It just says in verse 61, as according to this law of the priesthood, if she's married, and then it talks about 10 virgins and all that stuff. Go down to 63. It doesn't qualify it, and that's the puzzle. We could. I mean, we can qualify
okay.
it.
Well, I won't dwell on that. So. I wanted to ask you.
No.
I have one other question about, and I would like Brian's opinion, but if anyone else wants to share theirs as well. I found one story told about Emma, and this I found in the Church History Library in an article called Emma Smith and Polygamy by Gary Anderson, and he was quoting Beardsley. And unfortunately, I don't have the full reference of Beardsley at my fingertips, but it says that Joseph explained to Emma that the Lord had commanded him to take these numerous wives, but she was still the elect lady in his own eyes and in the eyes of the Lord. And in proof of the fact, the Lord had given him a special revelation for her as the elect lady. Emma might enjoy the same freedom in regard to surplus husbands that Job had been permitted in the matter of wives. This was a very special privilege and was to be delegated to no other woman in the church. And I know that this directly contradicts what's in 132, where the revelation addresses Emma directly, basically says you should not have anyone else but Joseph Smith or I, God, will smite you. So I understand that contradiction, but I just wondered if that factored into your research.
Actually, if you go to William Law's comments, and I want to say, when was his interview? I've got it on my computer, but William Law makes the same allegation that that Emma was ticked off, and so William that Joseph said to Emma, well, you can have more husbands, and you can have William Law because he's such a cute little man. Now, Law said that that was not true, but this is not the only allegation. Beardsley's just not a good source. We need to find something better than that. But there are a lot of people who interpret a couple of the verses, and I can't give you the exact ones, but where Emma was offered something, and now he's saying, don't, you can't partake of that. A lot of people interpret that as polyandry for Emma. So, yeah, it's out there.
Okay, our time's up. Well, one more question, and then that'll be it.
Thank you. Hi, Brian. Sorry, I know you're getting a lot of questions. I got to say that I've always told people that polyandry is like the best idea that Mormonism ever had. I wish God would give me one of these polyandry tests, because I would totally pass. But your research is kind of going against what I'm just joking about that being the best idea. Your research is kind of going against what I always, one of the things I always kind of liked about Mormonism. But I wanted to say, this obviously doesn't really directly relate to your research, because you're just gathering up historical evidence and making your own argument, and I respect that. But what's wrong with, I understand the biological reasons why it doesn't work out, but as far as eternity is concerned, why should it be wrong for a woman to be with two different men that she loves? Thanks.
We have time for me to answer that.
Yeah.
It's
please,
an excellent
please
question.
Do.
And people often wonder, well, Brian, why do you say that he needs plural marriage so that all the extra women can be sealed to a husband? And because he never taught that. And my response is that if you read section 132, the only thing that it provides for is for a man to have more than one wife. That's my interpretation. And apparently at the judgment day, that's what's going to be happening. It's a conclusion. When Joseph Smith said that you have to be married to be exalted, unless you've got exact equal numbers of worthy men and women, either you're going to have polyandry or you're going to have polygyny. Polygyny is the technical term. And apparently, just based on what's in that section, it's going to be polygyny with one man having more than one wife. Do I believe every man in the celestial kingdom is a polygamist? No, there's not enough women to go around. I think there's a lot of monogamous men there. You can go home and repeat that in your leaf societies if you want to. But it's, I honestly believe it for those reasons. Did that answer?
I think you're telling me what the church teaches, not why it should be that way. That's okay. I respect the church.
Well, actually, it's what's taught in Section 132. Right. There's just no window in Section 132 for polyandry, so far as I read it. And but there is for polygyny. It says that Adam's on his throne. He's got his wives. I mean, it's there, but polyandry is.
He's asking if there's a moral basis for the differentiation discriminating against women, not allowing them to have extra husbands.
Well, and then when Joseph Smith received the revelation restoring plural marriage, it was a restoration of a biblical law. There's nothing that shows that the prophets in the Old Testament actually had any other lifestyle than polygamy.
But there's good biological reasons to not practice polyandry here. And in the eternity, you know, if I've had two different men in life, and I love my husband, he dies, I marry somebody else, why can't I be with the Pope? That's always probably a lot.
Well, I think with that, we'll end the session.
If you have a good answer, come on.
Everybody
can share with us.
Thank you very much for coming.